This is 89.3 FM KPDO in Pescadero on the South Coast, and this is Local Revolution. I'm Aaron Murphy, and on the program, we're going to discuss the local movement. What does it mean to buy local? What are the social, ecological, and economic benefits of the local movement? What organizations are working towards protecting people and the land in the food and farming labor industries? Well, we're going to speak with someone from one such organization. My guest today is Nina F. Ichikawa. Nina is the executive director of the Berkeley Food Institute. She joined the Institute in 2015 as an inaugural policy director, creating a policy education and engagement program for UC Berkeley's students, staff, faculty, and the general public. She previously served in the office of the U.S. Senator Daniel Inouye and with the U.S. Department of Agriculture's Know Your Farmer, Know Your Food Initiative. And in 2011, she was named a Food and Community Fellow by the Institute for Agriculture and Food Policy. And she was also the founding food and agriculture editor for Hyphen Magazine, and her writings on our changing food system has been published widely. Welcome, Nina.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
You know, I guess I want to start this off because really what this show is about this. What does the local movement mean to you?
Great question. Well, you know, I love that you're taking the lens wider than just local food. It absolutely is about local food, but it's also about community control of our resources. It's about democratic participation. It's about a type of sovereignty, including food sovereignty, but also economic and other types of sovereignty. It's about communities getting a chance to determine what will happen in our neighborhoods. So it's a lot, and I applaud you all for taking it on.
Well, thanks. And, you know, I know I want to get into what your work is and a bit of your background and what the Berkeley Food Institute, its work is about. But I know there's a really big program that y'all are a part of right now. It is Take Out the Vote. Can you tell me a bit about that? And how does that connect to the Berkeley Food Institute?
Sure. Well, we launched that just a couple months ago. It's a nonpartisan effort to encourage two things. One is that communities and folks will go and support local restaurants who are really struggling in the COVID-19 time, and to do takeout from those restaurants so that it's safe, socially distanced, patronize those restaurants with takeout. And while you're there, to check your registration, register to vote if you haven't already, and get yourself all ready to vote in this very, very important election that's ongoing right now. And we partnered with vote.org, who's made some great tools to make it very easy and safe for people to either check their registration, to register, or to request an absentee ballot. So it's been a lot of fun getting in touch with restaurants all around the country, and we know that they're just, particularly independent, locally owned restaurants are such a community hub. They provide a lot of important jobs, and we want to help them get through this hard period.
You know, looking at the list of participating restaurants on the Berkeley Food Institute website, it shows me that the food choices, even where you eat, it's not just about food and sustenance, but it's also, you know, in many ways, a political or even a revolutionary force. Can you speak about that a little bit?
Restaurants are taking a stand. You know, some restaurants are speaking up that it's important to vote or that they support Black Lives Matter, and sometimes are getting pushback for that. So, you know, it's hard enough to run a restaurant. So I have so much respect for some of these restaurant owners who are really trying to use their platforms to drive more civic participation. And yeah, so they have a really important role in our communities. And we want to applaud what they're doing. Also, you know, there's a really exciting movement right now to make restaurant work more fair and equitable. And we also partnered with the Raise Network, which is a network of high road restaurants. Many of them are not doing any tipping. Many of them are making sure that the restaurant workers have a fair and fairly compensated and safe job. And that's also important. And we've found that we can have our cake and eat it too. And that restaurants, there's a progressive bent of many restaurants that are trying to make the industry work for their workers as well as customers. So
I see on the website for Berkeley Food Institute that there, this program, you know, you can print out posters. Restaurants can find posters and graphics and stuff to put in their windows that tell people about Take Out the Vote and this movement.
Yeah.
And it seems like also a neat opportunity to for folks who may not know about the Berkeley Food Institute to find out about the important work that it's doing. What can you briefly tell me? I know it's a lot, but in a couple sentences, what is Berkeley Food Institute?
Yeah, and before I get into that, I'll just say the last thing on Take Out the Vote is we also have coloring pages for kids. Anyone can download that, and any restaurant around the country can download the materials for free. Didn't want to have any paywall or anything. Please help yourself to the materials on the takeoutthevote.org website and let us know if you're using them so we can help promote you. So we just wanted to sort of do a social media campaign and engage those folks that are really into restaurants, and we know that that's just a part of our food landscape. The larger Berkeley Food Institute was established in 2013 on the UC Berkeley campus, and we are a cross-disciplinary research and action institute. We were founded by the schools of natural resources, public health, law, public policy, and journalism at UC Berkeley. And since then, we've actually added three more schools within UC Berkeley. So it's a group of people really dedicated to studying all of the problems in our food system from a cross-disciplinary lens and trying to solve them together. And pardon the noise, but I have two kids here at home, so we're all sharing the workspace.
These are the times we live in.
Indeed.
Well, you know, that seems really important and such a great thing for food workers, for farm workers, I think, to find out about. But tell me a little bit about your role at the Institute. Sure. You know, it looks like your job title involves engagement around justice and sustainability efforts. But also, can you tell me, you're also responsible for the policy part of that. And what does that mean to you?
Yeah, well, yeah, let me break it down to more manageable bits. So, you know, when Berkeley Food Institute was established, you know, we saw the problem of a lot of food work happening sort of in silos, right? That, you know, some folks are working on anti-hunger, which is very crucial and important. Other folks are working on public health, you know, the explosion of diet-related diseases in our country and worldwide. This is of high concern. And of course, you know, problems on the farm in terms of sustainability, pollution, and economic viability for farm communities. And what we are trying to do is have those problems and solutions talk to each other and have our students and the community members that we work with be able to look at all of those parts of the food system. And I know it can be a lot, but we break it off into projects that we feel are very crucial. And one of those is policy. So let's see. I mean, one way that we've really engaged in policy is through the Farm Bill. So the Farm Bill is a huge piece of national legislation that governs a lot of our food system. Everything from food stamps or SNAP to support for farmers for doing good or not so good practices, trade policy. And so we launched an education effort as well as a public symposium we held in DC with American University, published academic articles and getting more people aware. What is the Farm Bill? How can you become empowered to participate in it and know that your opinion matters? So that's just one of the projects we've worked on with regards to policy.
Right. That seems really important because that does actually have a really important immediate impact on people's futures, both for employment and obviously the economics and trade. I mean, that's pretty big. And that really does, you know, because I think for a lot of people, just the idea of policy, both as an academic study, but then also as it relates to the real world and laws and how governments operate, it can be a vague thing. But when you break it down, that the Farm Bill and different bills, different laws ultimately do impact in people in a very real way. So it does seem important to spread awareness and to get more people involved.
And the thing is that they're changeable, you know, any mistake is fixable. We're just mortal humans creating these laws. And we think that research should inform policymaking. It should be evidence-based. We do feel that science still has a really important place in the United States of America. We want to make sure that scientific results are understood by policymakers. So it's a two-way communication, right? How do we understand policy and how do we communicate science as well as citizen, you know, priorities to policymakers, because ultimately it's our money, you know, and if we need to feel comfortable with how it's being spent, or else we have to change that. is what I feel.
So it looks like it's like about civic engagement. So your take out the vote is part and parcel of that. And I can see how it relates. That seems really important. And it also seems like Berkeley Food Institute is really interested in protecting farmers and laborers, you know, and really just presenting equitable and distribution for restaurant workers, grocery workers, and the nutritional quality of food. I mean, that's so much bigger than just farming support. I mean, it seems like Berkeley Food Institute really is looking at a lot of how people eat and produce food and deliver it and buy it. And that's a lot to take on. Do you feel like you're making good progress?
Definitely. Well, here's my dream, is that everyone would understand that there is what's called a food web is what creates our food, right? And so that our food does not just magically appear on the shelf or on our plate, but that it is cultivated, or an animal is grown, has to go through processing, manufacturing, distribution, before it comes to us, consumption. And then after consumption, there's waste. What happens to the food? And then does it go into a landfill or into a compost bin, or, you know, what happens to it? So that whole circle is all connected. And problems at one point can affect the whole thing. And I guess the dream of our institute, or myself personally, is that we can all get our heads around that. You know, we're a largely urban country, so many people are disconnected from the source of their food. Folks like, you know, Michael Pollan, or, you know, other writers have helped to open our eyes about the food system. And what do we do once our eyes are open that way? How do we understand how it all fits together and take a more participatory role in it, and also look around to our local community, since you emphasize local, and understand what types of food production are happening in our area, and, you know, do they reflect our values? So maybe our air, you know, if you're living in South San Francisco, it's not a heavy dairy production area, but it is a heavy food manufacturing area. You know, there's a lot of factories and companies that are manufacturing food, and a lot of innovation. And so that's a, you know, wonderful, you know, role you're playing in that food system. So yeah, we aim to do research that informs and improves that whole connection and invites regular people into that, participating in it.
I know in my history in dealing with sustainability, my background in trying to live as sustainably as possible, my efforts in producing food myself and trying to eat sustainably, you know, I know that all of those things are so intertwined. And I find that even when I started doing this radio program, Local Revolution, you know, it started out as, you know, maybe we would be talking about farmers markets and healthy food. And yes, you know, the, you know, properly disposing of waste and maybe using fewer chemicals. But then when I started to peel it back, I discovered that it's actually about how we treat each other. It's how we treat immigrants. It's about protecting land so it can continue to be fertile into the future. You know, it's just so much bigger than the food piece. And it does seem that the food is, you know, it is such a critical part of our everyday lives that we all share. And so from that standpoint, it just turns into this giant issue that really involves all of life. Do you agree?
Yeah, I know. It really involves all of life. And I mean, I guess we take it from the attitude that, you know, choose a small window through which to see the whole world, right? And that's how we don't get overwhelmed, is that there's so much happening, but we are picking specific windows to look through that can help us understand and help us change that system. Because really, yes, exactly right, what you said is that food can be a wonderful tool for connection, joy, health, happiness. It can make so many people happy, and it's a wonderful thing to have. We're so lucky to have it, if you have it. Or, you know, it can hasten your death. It can, you know, be very painful to be without food, or you can have a terrible job in the food system where you're exposed to COVID or risk of death every day. So how do we move our food system along that spectrum to an area of greater health and nourishment is what we're thinking about.
For those of you just joining us, we're talking with Nina Ichikawa. She is the executive director for the Berkeley Food Institute. The Berkeley Food Institute seeks to transform food systems to expand access to healthy, affordable food and promote sustainable and equitable food production. You know, I wanted to briefly touch on some of the priorities that the Sure. Berkeley Food Institute has. I see on the website, number one is agroecology. Can you can you briefly describe what agroecology is as one of the three Sure. major areas that you prioritize?
Sure. And we define it as both rural and urban agroecology, because we are really looking at farming in both urban and rural contexts. So agroecology is an approach to agriculture that is looking at natural systems and is in constant interaction with natural systems and is seeking to replenish natural systems and not just extract from them. So it is a practice. It's a area of research for many researchers all around the world. It's also an area of practice that many farmers and gardeners and others are, you know, constantly experimenting with and trying to get better. It's a, you know, I think it's a another way of saying sustainable agriculture, but even more complex, because it really includes the research side and it also includes the community side, which we think is very important. So, you know, if a university researcher is really studying agroecology in a given location, it has to also incorporate that local bioregion, but also the people that live there. That's agroecology. It's a higher standard for agriculture that I'm constantly inspired by how many farmers and food producers are trying to get there.
Berkeley Food Institute is prioritizing fair and healthy jobs, which I think Yes. I can understand. What about the third Mm-hmm. leg of your priorities, good food access? What exactly does that mean?
Yeah, great question. So it's really about access to food and healthy food. And that's, I guess, more you could call our public health area of work. So we've done a fair amount of research and also gatherings and policy work on SNAP, the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, which is food stamps. And I don't know if you've heard, but it feeds about 1 in 8 Americans. At least that was pre-pandemic. That might be now increasing. So how do we improve and understand the impacts of that program has been a major emphasis of work. And another area of work in good food access has been looking at soda taxes. So, you know, good food access means how are you able to access good food, or how are other foods, you know, causing you or your community's harm? So Berkeley, the city of Berkeley, was the first city in the country to pass soda taxes. And, you know, that's the city we are in. And so it was a natural experiment to be able to study what happened with those soda taxes, how did they impact communities, how was that money spent, and how has the expansion of soda taxes, you know, changed our landscape. So that's another area that we're looking at closely. So good food access is about, I guess you could say, more the consumption side of the food system, or what's on our plate and in the glass we're drinking from.
It appears that one of the major goals is also to create a discussion for mm-hmm. students, for the public, and hopefully get people involved to maybe choose to work in government or law or non-government organizations to continue the work of kind of food justice. Can you talk about Absolutely. That piece of what the Berkeley Food Institute is doing?
And of course, food business also plays a role in that. The private sector, you know, there's so many interesting places that our graduates have gone on to, and also places that our faculty advise on. And as part of the UC system and our public university system, you know, we have a responsibility to the public to, you know, share our insights. And, you know, our virtual doors now are always open to, you know, California and how we can help California get better. The United Nations and many countries have declared food to be a human right. The United States has not. And we have an ongoing discussion about who deserves good food and who doesn't. We don't talk about it all the time, but, you know, there's a social understanding that, say, food in prisons should not be good quality. That we should spend very little money on school lunch, public school lunch, that we should quibble with people receiving SNAP. We should quibble with them month in and month out, whether they quote unquote deserve it or not. To me, that's not food justice. To me, food justice is about living up to the United Nations Charter, to the international right to food, to understanding that no human can live without food, and particularly in one of the richest nations in the world, United States, we can afford to have everyone have good food, and we have to fix the inequities that are preventing that from taking place. So it is a very big task, but luckily we have people of all different talents who are finding just the right place for them to participate. It might be, you know, a local school district where they're working on school lunch. As you said, it might be a government agency, it might be a nonprofit, it might be a company, or it might be, you know, an educational institution like a university. But there is so much to do, and I'm really, struck by the talent and enthusiasm of lots of people jumping in to say that they're going to make their career be for food justice.
Well, talking about justice, can you talk to me about the impact that your work has on immigrants who work in the farming or food services?
Well, we funded a few UC Berkeley research projects on immigrants in the food system. We have about 155 affiliated faculty and staff, meaning these are folks at Berkeley who are researching and writing and speaking on food and agriculture. And a fair amount of them are working particularly on different parts of immigrants in the food system. I can send you the link after and to share with your listeners, but one research project that is just now concluding really looked at gender among immigrants and SNAP, meaning some immigrant communities or limited English communities were struggling with whether women and men would both be able to apply for SNAP. Like, there was division among families, and researchers came to us with this problem, which we hadn't heard of. And it interacted with our immigration system, where families were worried that if both a mother and father sign up for SNAP, that would disqualify them for, you know, green card status. So these kind of issues we wanted to look into and understand more and bring to light, you know, in the research and public conversation. One of our researchers that is doing a lot of great work on this is a filmmaker named Andres Cediel. He's at the journalism school. He just won an Emmy for one of his films, and his films do really look at immigrants in the food system, particularly farm workers. And he has a movie called Trafficked, which looks at Guatemalan teens and other Central American teenagers being trafficked to work in egg farms in Ohio. So a lot of, you know, things that are happening right under our noses. And, you know, the food system has always, our American food system has always really relied on immigrants. My own family, I'm descended from immigrants who were farm workers, and I know how hard it was for them. So being willing to push back that curtain and look objectively and seriously at what that means for our food system, I think is really important.
So you're an Asian American yourself. Did your family have a connection to the food or farming industry growing up?
Yeah, well, my great-grandparents came from Japan on my mother's side, and my great-grandfather was a farm worker in Oakland in the fruit. There's a Fruitvale district of Oakland, which used to be fruit orchards, and he went on to start a flower nursery in Richmond, which my family had for 112 years until 2017. So I did grow up in the farming business, well, the flower business. But I was reminded recently, it wasn't just flowers, because we also grew and sold trees, you know, flowering fruits and vegetable starts, and, you know, it was a nursery business. So I've done some writing, and I am interested in Asian Americans in the food system, and my own family story was full of twists and turns. So, but I'm very grateful, because their very, very hard work, you know, enabled me to go to college and gave us some type of a beginning in the United States.
Well, there's a long history of Asian American farmers and Asian farmers in the Bay Area and throughout many parts of the West Coast and the U.S., honestly. Yep. But can you tell me about the impacts that the internment camps of World War II had on families, maybe even yours?
Well, you know, some people theorize that actually Japanese American incarceration and the terminology has kind of shifted in recent years to remove the euphemism of it, that it was really incarceration, or it's also the accepted term is to say American concentration camps, because that's what they were. And there was a lot of pressure to enact those camps by West Coast farming interests. So it was not just about national security, as was said at that time. The U.S. was in a war with Japan, and there were many people who were descendants from Japan, many of them, most of them American born, so they were Americans. So in the time of hysteria, not unlike what we have now, there was a time of hysteria, an anti-immigrant hysteria, but it was encouraged along by farming interests who felt very threatened by the rise of Japanese American farmers. And in the time before World War II, some, not all, but some Japanese American farmers were getting quite successful. Even there was a first Japanese American millionaire who was a potato grower up in the Sacramento area named George Shima. So yeah, there was, that was a huge blow because people lost probably millions or billions of dollars worth of equipment, land, and crops. And they were shipped off to American concentration camps, about at 120,000 people, most of them American citizens. And when people came back, I mean, my family was lucky enough to hold on to our land in the Richmond area, but many families were not, or they just, either they could not hold on to land or they did not want to return to a community where they had been treated so poorly. So many people sort of fled. They fled racial violence and intimidation, and they lived in, maybe moved to an urban area or another part of the U.S. like Chicago or New York or something. So it had a, I think, both an economic and a cultural impact on our community to try to push us out of farming and food production on the West Coast. It was not all the way successful, but it was partially successful. And a lot of people don't know that early role that Japanese Americans played in tilling the soil here on the West Coast.
You know, I live and work in Pescadero, California, and our—
Yeah, such a beautiful area.
Yeah, uh-huh. It is. And our FM transmitter is situated on a piece of farmland that includes a farmhouse that was built and gifted to a Japanese family after World War II, after those concentration camps closed, and as part of reparations for harm done to at least this one particular family, they were gifted this farmhouse on this piece of land, and now it just sits empty, and I really want this to be a historical site.
Yeah, I'd love to hear more of that story, and I hope, are you able to find the family who was there, who used to be using that farmhouse, or... their descendants scattered around?
I do not know the history of it. I will look into it because it does seem really important. And there's other examples actually in Pescadero of farmland that piece of property in particular was abandoned. And a lot of the infrastructure, including a tractor and a barn, mm-hmm. are like frozen in time a testimony to the tragedies that happened in the past. But it sounds like the work that you're doing is really touching on a lot of things, including, defending the interests of immigrants, working and living in the food system, social justice for people, better food. I'm just really impressed by Berkeley Food Institute's mission. And so thank you so much for talking to me about it. How do folks connect with either you or the Berkeley Food Institute?
Oh, thank you so much for asking, and thanks for your kind words. We'll definitely check out our website, and I appreciate you looking so carefully at it. It's food.berkeley.edu, and if you scroll to the bottom, that's where folks can sign up for either our general newsletter, which we send out maybe about monthly and has a lot of news and information, as well as our student opportunities newsletter, which is sort of our job board, and even if you're not a student, but if you're interested in having a job in the food system, I encourage you to sign up. And myself personally, I guess I share interesting research and my rants on Twitter, just like everyone else does. And that's at Nina Ichikawa, at Nina Ichikawa on Twitter. And sometimes I publish writings or other things on there. So between our website and my own Twitter, I think we can stay in touch. And I'd love to hear from your listeners. And I just love the frame you all are putting on these issues. So thank you very much.
Well, Nina, thank you so much for joining me here on Local Revolution. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you. Have a wonderful day.
This has been Local Revolution on 89.3 FM KPDO in Pescadero and the South Coast. Thanks for listening.